four sermons based on the law of God. Sometimes I think I feel I've gone a little fast through some of these. It's a huge, huge subject. In the first sermon, I covered the spiritual intent and definition of the law and Christ's magnification of the law. In the second sermon, I covered the commandments, the judgments, and the testimonies. The third covered the statutes, precepts, words, and edict. And the fourth, which was last week, which categories of the law are not applicable under the new covenant. We covered in that sermon the ceremonial aspects of the law no longer apply, such as the meat offerings, the drink offerings, the various washings of the Levitical priesthood that were imposed until the time of Reformation, until the time that all this pointed to Jesus Christ. The second was there was a change of the law regarding the priesthood, found in Hebrews 7, to show that we're now once again under the priesthood of Melchizedek, just as we saw that Abraham was, which is Jesus Christ. And also, in 2 Corinthians, we found that we're under the administration of the Spirit. If someone here happens to break the Sabbath, you don't have to worry about any of the deacons or elders or ministers going out and stoning you. That won't happen today. But it did under the laws in the Old Testament, which applied to that nation of Israel, that physical nation at the time. So we see that there's been a change in the civil administration. And now we see that Jesus Christ came to magnify the law, to emphasize the spirit and intent of the law, which brings us to our subject today. So whenever we're looking at these laws, the first thing that the mind ought to do, coupled with the Holy Spirit of God, is to go, what is the purpose of this? What is the purpose? Why would God do this? What's the foundational purpose and the intent? And if we can establish that, in so many cases, in most cases, it will make clear why God said what he said. Would he do away with what he said? So the difference in approach, though, regarding the law in the Old Testament and the way the law came to be regarded among the Jews in the New Testament is what I'd like to talk about today. When people read the New Testament today, they read the Gospels of the encounters that Jesus had with the Pharisees. There are those who conclude that somehow that Christ was opposed to the law, that the Pharisees were upholding the law, and now that the change was that Christ was showing or doing away with it. That, of course, is just not the case whatsoever. As we saw at the beginning of this series on the law, Jesus said in Matthew 5, verse 17, I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. Jesus did not come to tear down the law. He did not come to nail it to the cross. He came to reveal, to testify, and to live according to the purpose and intent of the law. That through the strength of the Spirit, as he exemplified, that it was possible to keep the law and to make it honorable. But the Pharisees had a total different approach to the law. Let's go to Matthew chapter 23, verse 1. Matthew 23, verse 1. And let's see what Jesus himself spoke of here. Matthew 23, verse 1. Then Jesus spoke to the multitudes and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. Therefore, whatever they tell you to observe, that observe and do. See, as they quoted and spoke from the law, the Torah, that's why he said this. But do not do according to their works, for they say and do not do. So what did that make them? I think we understand the word that he even called them. Therefore, whatever they tell you, observe, that observe and do. But verse 4, we find the problem. For they bind heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on men's shoulders. Now, if we just took that verse by itself for a minute, was that the intent of God's law from the beginning? Can we look at all those laws at the very beginning and say the purpose that God made these laws was to lay heavy burdens on men's shoulders? So there has to be an obvious distinction that he's talking about something different other than the law that he gave to Israel by that one alone. He says, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers, but all their works they do to be seen by men. I probably mentioned an example here back when I went to the wall, Jerusalem, the Wailing Wall, where many used to go to. If you were a Gentile or a foreigner, you were blocked from access. There was a gate there, and you had about another 20 yards to go before you got to the wall. So I couldn't go up to the wall personally, but I watched as many of these Jews would go up there and put their little prayer requests in the cracks of the wall. And as I observed some of them, they would be bowing many times, 10 or 12 or 15 times, continuing to bow before the wall. But occasionally they would lift their head up and they would look over to see if anybody was watching. I thought that was very interesting. It's almost like if you're praying before God, then you're kind of looking around, is somebody watching me here? And we kind of figure, what's the purpose of this here? But again, you know, kind of exemplifying here what Christ was saying, all their works they do to be seen of men. So the approach of these scribes, the Pharisees and others, was based on what Christ was saying. It was all based on outward show, display. Christ was not attacking or undermining the law given by God in the Old Testament. After all, who was the lawgiver of the Old Testament? None other than the one speaking at that very time, Jesus Christ himself, the God of the Old Testament. Let's look at 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 1. 1 Corinthians 10 verse 1. Paul points out kind of a likeness here, not that the Israelites were baptized like there's baptisms today, but if you remember even the Old Testament, there was a baptism unto John the Baptist. There were disciples of John the Baptist. This is what Paul was talking about here. He said in 1 Corinthians 10 verse 1, moreover, brethren, I don't want you to be unaware that all of our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea. They were all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. It was a type, he was saying. All ate the same spiritual food, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that accompanied them. And that rock was Christ. So here we find the Bible interpreting itself as to who that was. Jesus Christ was the same one who led the Israelites through the wilderness. He was the one who gave them the laws, the statutes, the judgments, the testimonies, the commandments, the precepts. He didn't come to do away with his Father's commandments, and he didn't come to do away with the ones he gave to Israel through his servant Moses. Allow me to quote from a book titled The Essential Talmud by Aden Steinsaltz. I think you can understand this man's background. Aden Steinsaltz from The Essential Talmud. This is from the introduction. Quote, it's impossible to understand Judaism or the Jews themselves, either the system of Jewish belief and practice, without a basic understanding of the Talmud. It is a sacred text and an actual code of law for the governing of civic life. It is the fullest expression of Jewish attitudes and traditions, unquote. So you can see with this, we're going to find out what the problem was, what became of God's laws, what the Jews started doing. Remember as we discussed this, remember how many times God said, according to his laws, do not add to or diminish from them. This was the problem. This is where you find the heavy burdens that were bound. In many ways, the Talmud is the most important book in Jewish culture. But one may think that the Bible is the most important book. Now, certainly the Bible is the most important book, but the Talmud is the most important book in Jewish culture. No other work has a comparable influence on the theory and practice of Jewish life. Now, that should say something, because the fact should remain that no other book has a comparable influence than the Bible on the basic practice and life of a Christian. But what is the Talmud? The formal definition of Talmud is that it's the summary of all law that evolved over centuries of scholarly efforts by sages. Some may call them wise men. I call them wise guys. who lived in Palestine and Babylonia, stretching back up until the beginning of the Middle Ages. It's basically a warehouse of the oral law. The Pharisees regarded the oral law just as significant as the written law, which, of course, we're going to find out was added. Much of what is brought out in the Talmud are the things that Jesus Christ was addressing when he dealt with the Pharisees. What Jesus expressed was not a disagreement with the laws of the Old Testament. The Pharisees had bound heavy burdens, grievous to be borne, as Christ spoke of in Matthew 23, verse 4. Their approach to the law was to invent all kinds of ideas of human do's and don'ts that if you can't find if you just read in your Bible. Now, many of us can relate of this because it's a natural tendency of man to do this. And at one point in the church in the past, some of you remember that we did those things. A man couldn't have his hair a half inch below his collar. You know, other things that were bound. Now, the important part is we teach principles of modesty and of dress, but not going to elements of calling hair over the collar a half inch a sin. That was the problem. And we adjusted, make adjustments, and still do, to identify the intent, once again, of God's law. This was the problem of the Pharisees. They came up with ideas that in their minds fulfilled the intent of the law. These were ideas, by the way, when I say evolved, they were developed over time, over a period of time. But Jesus told them over and over that the Pharisees and their followers were in reality willing to lay aside the law of God in order to keep their traditions. Some may find that today within some of the churches of God. There are those that are commanded not to have contact, even with their mom and dad, if they belong to another organization. Which commandment do you think that would violate? Obviously, the fifth. So there's a law that's written out there that's established that violates, that goes contrary to the very word of God, the very commandment of God today. But let's look at an example here in the Old Testament. In Mark 7, verse 1. Mark chapter 7, verse 1. And that's where we find a lot of times a misunderstanding on the laws of clean and unclean and of the washings and of different things. It's pointed out here in Mark 7, verse 1. Then the Pharisees and some of the scribes came together to him, having come from Jerusalem. Now when they saw some of his disciples eat with defiled, that is, with unwashed hands, they found fault. Now, you find defiled here means common or unwashed. Now, was the issue that of washing one's hands before they ate? No, that wasn't the issue, as some may think it was. I mean, how many here sometimes have eaten with unwashed hands? The problem was that you may have come into contact with something that was ceremonial, unclean, or even having brushed up against a Gentile. To this would be crazy today. You brushed up against a Gentile, somebody that's not in the church today, and he had to go through a ceremonial washing before you ate. See verse 3, he points it out. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands oft. Now from the New King James, this means, in a special way, diligently, almost like a doctor as he washes his hands to his elbows. It says, holding the tradition of the elders. Verse 4, and when they came to the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And he says, there's many other things that they have received and hold, like the washing of cups, pitchers, copper vessels, and tables. So once again, we see any problem here with actually wiping down or washing? No, it was the ceremonial method in which they went about doing this. And we found out once again there were certain things that God said when it came to the temple and other things based on the Old Testament law there. This is not to be intertwined with what people were doing in their civil life. Not that they were to not wash hands, but this was in a ceremonial way. Then the Pharisees and scribes asked him, why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat bread with unwashed hands? And he said to them, well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written, These people honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. They were more interested in their own traditions than the laws of God. Isaiah 29, verse 13 is where you find where he quoted here. He says, and in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. Now, even if you went back, brethren, and looked at this, he said commandments of men. When you look back, even to the ceremonial washings that were done in the temple, were those commandments of men? No, they were not. These were commandments of men. It was never God's intent for the Israelites, before they ate their food, to go through some kind of ceremonial washing. To be clean, yes. So how would you feel, though, if someone brushed up against you or touched you, looked at you with a kind of a funny look, and then proceeded to go to a wash basin and tediously do a scrubbing, basically treating you as if they just touched a dead rat? You know, spiritually, that's how some treat others today, by the way. You know, so we can see that they elevated their tradition above the law of God. I'd like to quote a little bit more from the Essential Talmud. This is regarding the Sabbath. Quote, the basic view of the Sabbath as a day of rest appears very simple, but it arouses a number of problems when put into practice. First and foremost, it is necessary to establish the definition of labor. The oral tradition comments on this that the prohibition is not related to the definition of labor or the payment of money, but to the injunction to refrain from acts of deliberate creation in the physical world. The children of Israel are called upon to refrain from creative work on the Sabbath. Now, don't forget, this was a version of these wise guys that were putting the intent of God's law together. That's why even when I read out of that, you're kind of going, huh? What does that mean? See, the tabernacle was forbidden to be worked upon on the Sabbath. And so they analyzed, what happened is they analyzed the basic activity that was carried out during the construction of the tabernacle, and they summed up a basic list of 39. Now, why 39? You know, they always came up, God's number, we found out, he's got different numbers, by the way, but one of God's numbers that we see 40 days and 40 nights, we see 40, we see the number 40. And when the Pharisees would even lash out or do lashes, they did 39 because they prided themselves that just in case they missed and miscounted, that they do 39. So they always did one shy of 40. It's very interesting, as God's number is 40, they come up with 39. A list of 39 labors are prototypes of the work that was forbidden and permitted on the Sabbath. Any of you have that list out there today? I've never had such a list. Each of these 39 basic categories of labor has its offspring, each differing in detail. For instance, the conclusion was made that writing is forbidden on the Sabbath. All right, put your pens down. I mean, this is serious. Writing was forbidden. And there's so many more. I pointed out here before that you could not carry, one of the things that just shocked me that I found years ago, was you could not carry over half the weight of a dried fig on the Sabbath. You can't carry your Bibles then. Half the weight of a dried fig. I mean, can you see when Christ said they bind heavy burdens to be borne? You don't almost have to look at what, okay, how much does this weigh? So they decided that two letters constituted a significant unit so that writing more than one letter would be regarded as work in the fullest sense of the word. This is how detailed it got. Another quote from the book. The work that does not call for mental effort is not creating. A man who carries out a certain action unthinkingly and later discovers that he created something is not engaging his work since his efforts lack the component of intention. So you can say, well, I'm going to write a letter to my mom, but I'm not going to think about it. I mean, that's where this goes. We understand what Christ was talking about when he's talking about the commandments of men. God never intended that to be that way. And one rabbi came to the conclusion that a man who intended to pick a certain bunch of grapes, but picked another bunch instead, had not been truly working, even as far as he was concerned, there was no difference between them. So commerce does not belong in the general frame of the creative work, since what it produces is not physically evident. There was a prohibition against the handling of certain objects and utensils that were related to work forbidden on the Sabbath. One other quote here. In the general sense, the numerous Sabbath laws are an expanding network of minute detail. Almost sounds like the laws of our government today. That's why they call it, remember what I said, the statutes continuing. Revised statutes are a never-ending process in governments today. This quote, continuing here, deriving from several basic concepts which eventually create an almost Gothic structure made up of thousands upon thousands of tiny and meticulously fashioned details clustered around the original form, unquote. So you go to Israel today, and all your elevators are shut down. You can't press an elevator button because it kindles the fire. So you have to walk up the stairs instead. More work. See, what Christ was commenting on in the New Testament was not downplaying the importance of keeping the Sabbath. This is the point. What he was referring to was the thousands upon thousands of tiny and meticulously fashioned details that were the tradition of the elders. We find that the laws of ritual purity and impurity take up a whole order of the Mishnah, which is a part of the Talmud, even more than sacrificial law. Quote, the laws of purity are essentially a complex, and I highlight complex because whenever you see man's laws, see, you can't go back to God's laws and say these are complex. There was a purpose for them and for their intent. But here, a complex, unified network and interrelated. The Talmud devoted considerable space to them and offered no explanations. Just the ideas of men. Unquote. So there were all sorts of details that were created in their own process of developing their own law apart from the Bible. Many of the things practiced by the Jews go far beyond whatever God decided or intended. The process that God gave is not some matter of intricate reasoning to come up with some complicated formula. It's a basic, simple approach. The law is a statement of principles, of guidelines, of things that are to direct our path. It can direct our path in physical matters. It can direct our path in spiritual matters. It can direct our path in civil matters or ceremonial matters. One thing that one can find is that you cannot divide these laws into categories without some kind of overlap. How does one divide spiritual and physical? Sometimes we've tried to nail that down and you can't. On one level, we know that there are physical principles that God has set in motion. We are physical creatures. But when you consider it, the Ten Commandments are based on God's great spiritual law of love. The commandment says, you shall not steal. That prohibits a physical action. You shall not kill and you shall not commit adultery. Involve spiritual sins, but also involve physical actions. Ultimately, everything we do is physical. But on the other hand, there are physical prohibitions, such as refraining from unclean meats outlined in Leviticus. God said that the children of Israel were to be a holy people. He said, I want you to recognize that you are separate and distinct from all of the other nations. So God uses physical things to teach spiritual principles and spiritual laws to regulate our physical conduct. So we can see, once again, that interaction between the physical and spiritual. Now, there were ceremonial aspects that were basically physical in nature. There were laws of sanitation, of hygiene, and diet. There were often ceremonial aspects that were to use those physical principles to teach spiritual concepts. Sometimes the civil statutes were based upon spiritual principles that God had set in motion. But ultimately, the basis of God's law, we understand the basis the underlying principle and reasoning is based on God's law of love. That's his basic nature. That's his character. So Christ summarized the law in Matthew 22. Let's go to Matthew 22, verse 35. We went here in the very first sermon. Let's review this once again to drive this principle home. Jesus said in Matthew 22, verse 35, then one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question, testing him, saying, "Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law?" Remember, as we said from the beginning, here's a lawyer testing him. What was he going to test? What's the great one? Because if he pointed out number 8 or number 5, he would debate with him, go, what about number 1? What about number 3? If someone were to ask you today, which is the great one? Which is the number 1 in the Ten Commandments? Is it number 1? Is it number 2? God didn't answer that. They're all important. They all go together. You know, even remember the book of James. If you've broken one aspect, you've broken the law. Verse 36, "Teacher, which is the great commandment of the law?" He said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment." See, what was he driving the point home here? He was trying to drive the point home of intent. "The second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." So people will look at that and they'll think of hanging. Yeah, they hung. No. When you look at that, how you could lay that out, that's where it comes from. That's where the law and the prophets come from, the overall basis. So you can't say, well, the law is done away with, and not throw away the entire concept of love, of loving God and loving your neighbor. So the summation of God's basic law is love. Love toward God and love toward neighbor. The Apostle Paul spoke of the law in Romans 7:12. He said, "Therefore the law is holy, and the commandment holy and just and good." He said in verse 14, "For we know the law is spiritual." How many get that? The law is spiritual. Because if they're going to go point out one, well, thou shalt not kill, how is that spiritual? They forget the intent of the law. He said in verse 22 of Romans 7, "For I delight in the law of God according to the inward man." So how in the world can you do away with it? Because they'll pick and choose, as we know. Some of those scriptures, and as Peter said, some of the writings of Paul are a bit difficult to be understood. So we've got to go back there and go, what is he saying? But if you pick one thing, oh, look at here, the law is done away. What about what he says over here? More contradictions, huh? Sounds like it. But you know, when you really take a look at it, it's not. So we find that the detailed principles of God's law are an amplification of how you express love toward God and how you express love toward your neighbor. Even the ceremonial laws were to teach relationships, lessons about relationships with God, and the civil statutes were to teach and regulate the interaction of neighbors and the way to deal with each other. Now, we can say physical laws because we recognize that God is the great lawgiver and that there are principles of cause and effect. There are things that are designed to work and function in a particular way, and there are things that are designed not to work and function in a particular way. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 6, verse 19. Many of us have contemplated this for years on why God says certain things. I've thought about this for many years on why God did this. I didn't know this law for many, many years, for 14 years. I didn't understand God's law, nor, frankly, I don't even think I read it for 14 years. I don't ever think it was something brought up. So when laws of clean and unclean were brought to my attention, I said, what? I didn't realize, though. Then you conveniently try to explain them away, or other ministers or preachers would say, well, those are old Levitical laws. Those were applied to the Jews of the time, not even recognizing, once again, the Jews were just one tribe of the nation of Israel. But this goes beyond, as we know, reading our Bibles, we can see that the element, the teaching, the principle of clean and unclean went way far before the Israelites were even a thought.
That's why we read this in Genesis 6, verse 19. Quote, "And of every living thing of all flesh you shall bring two of every sort in the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female." Now, normally, people stop there. And that's what the picture showed. And any of the movies or cartoons that I saw about Noah and the ark, you always saw twos. Because they stopped there. Let's read the rest. "Of the birds after their kind, of the animal after their kind, of the creeping thing of the earth after its kind, two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive." And we say to this day, won't that be wonderful to talk with Noah and go, "How'd you do this? I mean, what kind of little thing did you have for a creeping thing? Here you had elephant cages, then you had grasshopper cages." You know, just like you went from really big cage to this, what'd you do there? Really, when you think about creeping things, or little mice or whatever. So we're going to have a little things department in the ark and a big things department. How God did all that, obviously, was a great miracle. But verse 21, it says, "And you shall take for yourself of all food that is eaten, and you shall gather it to yourself. It shall be for food for you and for them." Once again, if you just stopped here, that would be it. But we go to Genesis now, chapter 7, verse 2. Is this a contradiction? Here it says, "You shall take with you seven of each every clean animal." Here, back in Noah's time, before the Levitical priesthood, before the Israelites, before the Jews, you see a distinction of clean and unclean. A male and his female, two of each animals that are clean or unclean, a male and his female. Of seven of each of the birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of the earth. So here we find the knowledge of the laws of unclean and unclean all the way back to the time of Noah. Moses did not invent clean and unclean. There was a distinction of clean and unclean before the ceremonial law, before the priesthood of Aaron was ever instituted. There were principles that God had established from creation. God is the creator. He designed certain things for certain functions. And because you've got Google today, you can Google it and find out that many people, not associated with the church at all, understand, found out that pork isn't good for you. Found out that shrimp is bad for you. Yeah, very interesting. Good thought. And as I mentioned before, was it a thing, a law? Could you imagine God coming up with the idea because he's going, "Well, you know, we're kind of running low on fish. So I think we'll add in the other ones now." No, it's all for a purpose. When you look at the intent and the purpose, it makes sense. God certainly could have created all animal flesh good to eat. He could have made animals just like plants. Basically, if it tastes good, it's okay to eat. And God does not give a list of clean and unclean plants in the Bible. But normally, a person would not go make a salad of poison ivy leaves. At least not more than one time. See, there's usually a very immediate effect that tells somebody to stay clear. And we see a lot of these principles have been lost over the years. There were people that used to know what to do, what herbs did what, and that's all changed. And it's going to change again when Christ returns. Because once again, when we see a principle, a purpose for why God made things, when Christ returns, those things will be restored again. He will have branches and leaves and grapes and other things and herbs that people will be taught how to use those appropriately. So the point is that God gave us instruction. He has regulated in a way that we are forced to make a distinction between the clean and unclean in life. We are continually coming into contact with both, and we are confronted with making a choice. Choose one and reject the other. Now, these are physical matters, but God has designed it that way in order to teach a spiritual point. In life, we're constantly confronted with clean and unclean actions, clean and unclean thoughts. We're being trained that we need to be conscious always in every facet of our life of making a distinction between clean and unclean. Rejecting the unclean and choosing the clean because God designed it that way. Now, let's look at some of the physical laws. Back in Leviticus chapter 11. Leviticus 11, verse 2. Hear this, he speak to the children of Israel, saying, these are the animals which you may eat among all the animals that are on the earth. Among the animals, whatever divides the hoof, having cloven hooves, and chewing the cud, that you may eat. And we understand many of those. Sometimes if you're not, you know, informed on a lot of animals, sometimes it may come to the question. You just have to, really, when it comes to it, you have to look and watch. Does it divide the hoof? Does it chew the cud? Some will chew the cud, but not divide the hoof. The camel. And you can see other things. Some are specifically pointed out by God, but others, the principle here just stands. So God is spelling it out here, giving specific yet simple detail on what and what not to eat of the beasts or the animals. In verse 9, he talks about the fish, fins and scales. So I know after catching fish, because one of the greatest fighters off of Lake St. Clair was the Channel catfish. Wow, these things put up a fight. But I know, I think when I caught my first one, number one, you get poked by these things and it can cause an infection. Number two, I saw that they had fins, but interestingly enough, these were a little slippery guys. They had no scales. Well, they're all slippery, but no scales. Then I caught the perch, had fins and scales. Caught the walleye, fins and scales. And probably hundreds and hundreds of different varieties of fish that God's given us to eat. So once one was even called into question, you'll find that come up from time to time. I love the discussions on this. Because sometimes I thought the swordfish was it. I go, okay, we got the swordfish, and that's gray area. So I just told myself, I go, you know, if I don't know, there's hundreds of different varieties of fish. I'll know what I know to eat. I'll go that way. Because, you know, don't have to worry. But some people want to fight over gray areas. If you don't know, don't do it. So another one comes up recently. McDonald's has used this fish. The scales that are found, I don't know if the story is true or not. Supposedly, if you catch the fish, it loses its scales once you pull it up. So I guess you can eat the fish underwater. But don't eat it after you pull it up. I don't know, but it's one of those, I don't know what it's called, but it doesn't surprise me that there are sometimes gray area fish. As if, though, God did not give us enough. The mahi-mahi, the other, found one that was called the dolphin fish one time, and I didn't want to eat it. And they said, no, we just call it that. And found out it had fins and scales. It was pretty good fish. So there's lots of good fish to eat out there. That's verse 9. Verse 13, he speaks of the birds. Verse 20, he speaks of the insects. You can take the time to go through this yourself and spell it out. Some will have lists out there. If you Google sometimes, there are some lists that will make it a little bit more specific. Verse 22. Speaking of touching and washing. Now, these were not ceremonial rituals here. You'll find in verse 22. These are not ceremonial issues. So here we find physical principles of health. Due to the society that we live in today, we tend to take some of these principles for granted because we live in a society where water is plentiful and it's a very simple matter to throw something into the washing machine. But if you had to go out to a well and draw water with a bucket or go down to the nearest stream to bathe, the tendency would be to skimp a little bit on the washing of clothes or taking a bath, especially if you're talking in the wintertime. Just like, no way. Now, I know that there are those here that had to go down and get their water at one time. There weren't faucets around here that people could turn on. So for those here today who remember not having the luxury of running water, the frequency of taking a bath was no doubt much less today than we have due to the nature of the time. If you had to go out and boil the clothes in the old wash pot, utilize the scrub board and lye soap, and I had to do that one time, and I did not like it. It was not fun. That obviously became quite a chore. The point is that we may read these verses and take them for granted, the ease and the luxury that we have of washing today. But when you had a camp of millions of Israelites and didn't have washing machines, stuff spread really quick. So God was spelling out the need for the Israelites to clean. These were matters of sanitation and hygiene. It wasn't necessarily a crime or a sin to touch these animals. They just needed to make certain that if they did, they were to clean before coming back into a camp of millions of other people. You know, you can continue in verse 29 here. And if you see, once again, if you see principles that if there were cloth here, these things will be, clean and unclean. What chapter I'm here now? Let's go back. It's Leviticus 11, verse 29. All the creeping things that are unclean to you. And then we get up here to verse 33. Any unearthen vessel of which any of them falls, you shall break. Whatever it is shall be unclean. In such a vessel, any edible food upon which water falls becomes unclean, and any drink that becomes drunk from it becomes unclean. So if it was cloth or metal, you could take it out and wash it and scrub it. But if it was a vessel that was porous and had something had crawled in it and died, you could not clean a vessel. We understand that today. It simply had to be destroyed because God didn't necessarily explain about germs and bacteria as we know today. Verse 35, here it's speaking of when here we see everything on which a part of anything falls shall be unclean, whether it's an oven or a cooking stove. Now, as soon as I would see that, I would go, they had ovens back then? And I'm thinking of a manna, and other things. No, there were ovens, but nothing near like we've got today. So it's talking about specifically even about breaking it down, for they are unclean. See, these were sun-dried clay ovens that you can still find today being used in the Middle East, not the porcelain-laid, self-cleaning type that you've got today. So if you found some dead animal lying in the pool here, as it speaks of something laying in the water, you don't drink the water that's in the pool. But if it's a running spring, it hasn't contaminated the source. This, again, we're looking at the elements and finding out, why did God say what he did? Were these just a list that were adding burdens? No, they were helping to keep people to keep clean. One of the things that happened in Africa some years ago is when there were a lot of people that were killed in one area and they fell into the lakes, the people would go drink this water. And they'd get sick and diseased and died. So verse 36 here, well, whatever touches any such carcass becomes unclean. And then we're also talking about seeds. Verse 37, if any part of any such carcass falls on any planting seed which is to be sown, it remains clean. But if any water is put on the seed, and if a part of any such carcass falls on it, it becomes unclean to you. So once again, here's the seed that's used for planting, not for sprouting or eating. So we see God is giving detailed instructions in the area of cleanliness and hygiene. Verse 43, let's go up here. It says, you shall not make yourselves abominable with any creeping thing that creeps, nor shall you make yourselves unclean with them, lest you be defiled. For I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore consecrate yourselves, and you shall be holy, for I am holy. Neither shall you defy yourselves with any creeping thing that creeps on the earth. For I am the Lord who brings you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God, therefore shall you be holy, for I am holy. This is the law of the animals, of the birds, and of every living creature that moves in the waters, and every creature that creeps on the earth, to distinguish between the clean and unclean, and between the animal that may be eaten and the animal that may not be eaten. God's specific gets specific here again. Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 1. Now here's a very unusual one that we see. Why do you do this? Deuteronomy 14, verse 21. Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 21. Here he says, you shall not eat anything that dies of itself. You may give it to the alien who is within your gates that he may eat it, or you may sell it to a foreigner, for you are a holy people to the Lord your God. This is a statute that, yes, remains in effect. God says, don't eat something that dies of itself, but you can give it to a stranger. That doesn't make sense, does it? Unless we identify the intent. What would this be? Think of the word. What is God dealing with here? He deals with a lot of other principles that deal with this too. God is talking about quality. That's why when you see everything that was built, from the tabernacle, everything that had to deal with God, he said, I want you to use the best. So a lot of people today, well, I'm not going to let that one go.
see something that's fallen dead on the side of the road? Hey, it's a deer. No, he's looking for quality for his people. If we're going to subject ourselves that low when it comes to food, what does that say? What's the mindset for God's people? You know, this has dumbed down so many people. Because many people can say, God is a holy God to be worshipped. So they say, you know something, I'm going to dress down. I'm going to come to services in jeans. What are you telling God? When we come before God, we're a holy people. We come before to worship a holy God who made us. That is not to be diminished. And it's reflected in what we say, what we dress in, what we eat. This is a quality issue. Leviticus 17, verse 10. This was important to God here, too. Leviticus 17, verse 10. Here it says, "And whatever man of the house of Israel or of the strangers who dwell among you who eats any blood, I will set my face against that person who eats blood and will cut him off from among the people. For the life of the flesh is in the blood, and I have given it to you upon the altar to make atonement for your souls, for it is the blood that makes atonement for the soul." He was picturing something here once again. "Therefore I have said to the children of Israel, no one among you shall eat blood, nor any stranger who dwells among you eat blood." So not even the stranger or the foreigner. So you could give the one that died of itself, when it came to the blood, God said, no, this was representative of something, but also there was a physical application too. Blood's just not good for you. It contains a lot of bad things when you think about what spreads. So again, we find laws that are interacting here, don't we? It's not just one, it's two. He's reflecting on the principle of the blood having life in itself, and it was to represent something, and also there was a physical application. Verse 13, "Whatever man of the children of Israel or of the strangers who dwell among you who hunts and catches any animal or bird that may be eaten, he will pour out its blood and cover it with dust." You know, just in other words, here you're thinking of other people. You're also thinking of someone else. You're not just leaving it out there for someone to step in or to smell. You bury it. "It's the life of all flesh. Its blood sustains its life. Therefore, I said to the children of Israel, you shall not eat the blood of any flesh, for the life of all flesh, its blood, whoever eats it will be cut off. And every person who eats what died naturally, or what was torn by beasts, whether he is a native of your country or a stranger, he shall both wash his clothes and bathe in water and be unclean until evening." Once again, we see the application here of the principle of what was going on in the camp of Israel and how you had to be so particular or something would pass. You know what relates today, which brings it up today? You go into a hospital today, and I'm seeing these antibacterial dispensers all over the place. They're all over the place. You know what you find out? It's not stopping. It's not stopping the bacteria and the diseases that are still out there. Some would say, well, look, if some of the doctors would simply just wash their hands, you know what the big one that came out recently? How diseases spread within the hospitals? The computers. They come in and type information with their fingers on the computers. You know, sometimes if you thought about this, what's the dirtiest thing when you go into a hotel? What's going to be the dirtiest thing? Sometimes we'll look at the bedspreads. You know, it's hard to sometimes stay in a hotel anymore. You look at the bedspreads and go, who's been on that? You know, what's been going on around here? What is one of the dirtiest things in the motel room? The TV remote. Did you ever think about that? Hands are touching it. Who washes that? And yeah, it may seem like a small thing. It is not. It's not a small thing. These diseases and bacteria are running rampant all over the place, and people aren't thinking about what they're picking up and touching and who's touched them before. So there are principles that once again apply even today that we can see the problem with not washing things and with not washing our hands. Leviticus chapter 7, verse 22. Now we see the fat aspect. And I don't want to, I'm not saying this to mock anyone, but I had a question one time I thought was very interesting. They said, is there anything, when we see the applications here, someone said, well, is there anything wrong with putting the fat into the biscuits? Because I've known some, I don't think it's just relegated to the South, but the South has this flavoring sometimes also that's used more than it was in the North, not that it's not used in the North, but it's lard and other things. And so, well, but the flavor, you know, a lot of people would love that bacon fat. And the fat has got this flavor, and they go, well, but it makes it taste so good. So is there anything wrong with taking the fat and putting it into the biscuits? And I'm looking here at the scripture. I'm going, can we read this? Let's read it. Verse 23. Speak to the children of Israel, saying, you shall not eat any fat of ox or sheep or goat. And the fat of an animal that dies naturally and the fat of that which is torn by a wild beast may be used in any other way, but you shall not eat it. So here's something specific that says you can make a candle or soap out of it, but you can't eat it. And here, specifically. So we see that the fat could be used for soap or the making of candles, but not for food here. But whoever eats of the fat of the animal of which men offer an offering made by fire to the Lord, the person who eats it will be cut off from among his people. Just wasn't good for you. So you can't eat the fat, but you can put it in biscuits. No, because that's still eating the fat. But you can't see it like you can other things. No, you can't. It's still the fat. Notice that the prohibition against eating of fat was of animals such as oxen, sheep, goats, etc., etc. But there wasn't the prohibition of the fat of poultry, was there? But God prohibits the eating of the blood of any creature, but not the fat of the chicken. Did you ever notice the fat of the chicken is a lot different? It'd be really difficult to get fat off of chicken, wouldn't it? How do you do that? It's different. That's why there was no prohibition against that. Beef, that's obvious. Verse 26, moreover, you shall not eat any blood in any of your dwellings, whether of bird or beast. Whoever eats any blood, that person will be cut off among his people. What we're seeing here is something very serious by God. It's mentioned more than one time. So to argue that point today, and I've seen people drink the blood and say, this is the best part. I'm going, really? I almost gag. So here we can see health laws defined by God in detail. One, we're not to eat the fat of the beast. Two, we're not to eat the blood of any animal. And the third, we're not to eat something that dies of itself or that was killed and torn by animals, even if it was a clean animal. From a health standpoint, you don't know how long it's been lying there or if it was torn by a diseased or rabid animal. You just don't know. So let's look at some other laws of sanitation and cleanliness in Leviticus chapter 12. We find two different issues that are addressed in Leviticus chapter 12. There are matters of health, and there are matters that have a ceremonial aspect because they have to do with coming into the temple and offering a certain offering. Clearly, that aspect does not apply. But there are certain principles and guidelines that we can find in these scriptures. Again, remember guidelines, instruction, the law, guidelines for living. We've got to look at the intent. Verse 2 of Leviticus 12. Speak to the children of Israel, saying, if a woman is conceived and born a male child, then she shall be unclean for 7 days, as in the days of her customary impurity shall she be unclean. And on the 8th day, the flesh of his foreskin will be circumcised. Found out fascinating when my first son was circumcised. You know, was it necessary for salvation? See how that ties in once again? Find it so interesting. Physical applications as well as, at that time, a ceremonial aspect when it came to the Old Covenant. So did it do necessarily away with circumcision? No, but it did away with the point that circumcision was necessary for salvation. Now, it was under the Old Covenant. We have to see the intent and specific. But when I looked into circumcision, and you find out how it's a cleanliness and hygiene issue now, and I thought, you know, if it was good enough for Christ, who was, again, the beginner of the New Covenant, and Jesus himself had it done, you know, am I going to approach before Christ and he's going to go, why did you circumcise your kids and put them through all that pain? and I'll look at him, I'll go, because you were my example, and I followed your example, and he's going to say, well done. That's the point. So we see a physical application that's there. On the eighth day. What happens on the eighth day? Anybody know what happens physically on the eighth day within the male child? Vitamin K goes up. The level spikes. How interesting that is. What do they do now? Give you a vitamin K shot when you're born. They spike it then. Is that a good idea? I kind of like the natural route. I just don't trust the way of a man. Verse 4 has to do with the fact that there is a continuing discharge from a woman for a period of time following childbirth. If you add 33 and 7, you'll come up with 40 days. Normally, a doctor will talk about 6 weeks. Well, how long is that? Comes to 42 days. Kind of makes sense. Even if doctors nowadays would tell you that. Where did that wisdom come from? Here we find medical science coming to the conclusion of what God had instructed from the very beginning. Again, while these words are tied in with ceremonial aspects, there's also physical principles and guidelines that we can find as guidance and direction for our lives today. And I will tell the woman and give her that advice. It's good physical advice that after you have a child, and there's a difference between the male and the female, with all the chemistry within the body and what a woman goes through dealing with that, that there's different guidelines as far as the rest patterns. But the point is, normally, stay home and rest. Be with your child and let your body go through that recovering process. There are other guidelines I found out about because of things being passed on as far as the woman wrapping herself. So she gets that support. Those that haven't done that, their insides have prolapsed over time. So it's the physical principles that are here. Chapter 13 and 14 deals with health laws in terms of contagious diseases such as skin diseases, leprosy, etc. This is instruction to the priesthood as how they were to recognize something that was contagious from something that was not. They actually, when they had a disease, didn't go to a doctor. They went to the priesthood who told them God's instructions on what you're to do. So the priest played the role of the public health official. Today we have no Levitical priesthood that function, yet the principles and guidelines exist for our civil society. Today they're just applied in a different way. Let's look at verse 3 of Leviticus 13. And these were physical things that they were to take a look at that make sense even today, even though we don't find huge cases of leprosy, you find some. Verse 3, the priest shall examine the sore on the skin of the body, and if the hair on the sore is turned white, and the sore appears to be deeper than the skin of his body, it's a leprous sore. The priest will examine him and pronounce him unclean. But if the bright spot is white on the skin of his body and does not appear to be deeper than the skin and its hair is not turned white, then the priest will isolate the one. Ah, isolation! You had laws of containment and quarantine that you found here. And today, what happens? A lot of people will get a flu shot, come to work, spread it. There's isolation that made sense here. If the priest will examine him on the seventh day, and indeed if the sore appears to be as it was, and the sore is not spread on the skin, then the priest will isolate him another 7 days. It's getting better, but we're taking caution here. Then the priest will examine him again on the seventh day, and indeed if the sore is faded and the sore is not spread on the skin, the priest will pronounce him clean. It's only a scab. See how particular it got here? How detailed? So if it's scabbed, it's okay. He will wash his clothes and be clean. So the basic principles that God gave Israel in terms of health laws were laws of sanitation and hygiene and quarantine. If someone appeared to have an infectious disease, you kept him isolated until you knew for certain. No guesswork. What happens today? Principles the same way. People that are guessing at it have come and spread diseases and colds and flus. If someone came into contact with something that's contaminated, they are designated as unclean for a period of time. That means that they are in some level of isolation. They're just not free to come and mingle with everything and everyone until the matter is resolved. Now, that's happening now in some of the third world countries. The Red Cross is coming in and giving people food and clothing and shelter, but they're still dying because contamination and disease just spreads through everything.
Deuteronomy chapter 23, let's look over here and see once again the importance and the intent of what God was doing. As I had pointed out before, when you realize the exodus of Egypt and the enormity of the people that came out, there were millions of people and animals, millions. Not a couple hundred, as you'll see revealed in the Ten Commandments movie. It was millions of people that occupied a huge, huge territory. And if you didn't have laws of hygiene and cleanliness, disease would spread rampant. Verse 10 of Deuteronomy chapter 23, if there's any man among you who becomes unclean by some occurrence in the night, then he'll go outside the camp. He will not come inside the camp. So you'll find within even the borders at that time, there were borders of a campsite that were clearly designated and defined. It shall be when evening comes, he will wash with water, and when the sun sets, he may come into the camp. And you will have a place outside the camp where you can go out. And look how detailed it gets here. And you will have an implement among your equipment. And when you sit down outside, you will dig with it and turn and cover your refuge. This was the Israelites' Johnny on the spot. That's what they had then. And you will have an implement among your equipment, and when you sit down outside, you will dig with it and turn and cover your refuse. You didn't go to the bathroom and leave it out there for somebody to walk on. The decline of the death rate in the 20th century is probably not fully understood or even appreciated to be none other than the increase in sanitation and hygiene. There's many lessons that we've been learned. You heard of the bubonic plague and black fever, all kinds of different diseases that people had to learn because they weren't keeping God's health laws. Many died because of it. Apart from all the marvels of medical technology and science, the laws of sanitation and hygiene have played a major role in the prevention of the spread of plagues and infectious disease. Even as late as the 1860s, during the war between the states, battlefield surgeons would go from one soldier to another, simply wiping their knives on their trousers. And far more died from infection than from the wound itself. When you take these principles, you can see that when blood touched something, it had to be washed. If battlefield physicians of centuries past would have just practiced that one principle, think of how many lives would have been saved. Many of these things are very basic, but people still don't regard them. Other physical principles that are spelled out by God have to do with man's relationship with the environment. Let's take a look at a couple examples here. We've talked about laws of the environment. They're still there. The principles and applications are still there. Deuteronomy chapter 22, verse 6. Just a couple verses left here. But we'll tackle the one here on environment, and another one is one you'll go, really, he said that about that too? Here's one about the environment. Look what happens when it talks about the birds. You think, did God care about a bird in his nest? He cares about every aspect of his creation, including the grasshopper, the cricket, the worm, everything he made. He said, it's good. And there was a way to deal with it. Deuteronomy 22, verse 6. If a bird's nest happens to be before you along the way in any tree or on the ground with the young ones or eggs, with the mother sitting on the young or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall surely let the mother go and take the young for yourself, that it may be well with you and you may prolong your days. Really? How does prolonging your days fit into taking the young of the birds? It was a whole mindset. Because once you didn't care anymore, that was the problem. And we simply have people today that don't care. They don't wash after themselves. If you go into a bathroom at a rest area and you see the slop that people leave behind, or a toilet seat that needs to be wiped, and you go, I don't want to sit on this. Or frankly, cigarette butts at every intersection that you can see that people just dump out and don't care about anybody else. That was the problem. It was the intent. And God went to specifics here that says, I'm showing you how to care. How to care for my environment. How to care for my creation. Verse 80 says, when you build a new house, then you will make a parapet for your roof. We know here, Mr. Worden here knows very much about these safety regulations. And it wasn't, God didn't say, now this is section 12.8.4. There were principles here. You'll make a parapet for your roof. At that time, the Israelites would have second floor dwellings, and you know, you'd fall off the roof if you didn't have a fence to surround it. That you may not bring the guilt of bloodshed on your household if anyone falls from it. In other words, you built a house, you were responsible for making it safe. And you know who the safety inspectors were? The owners of the house. They were to make sure that that was taken care of. You shall not sow your vineyard with different kinds of seed. We've gone through this last week. The less the yield of the seed which you have sown and the fruit of your vineyard be defiled, you shall not plow with an ox and a donkey together. Ask someone that's done plowing before. Well, now that's not really a basic principle because now we have John Deere. But when you ask about that from people that have done that before, they will tell you the principles there that they don't pull in unison. There's principles there that God said when you put things together, this is how you do it. You shall not wear a garment of different sorts, such as wool and linen mixed together. See, we discussed that last week, the same principle that was found in Leviticus 19 as far as breeding your livestock together with another kind. Normally, again, you put two different animals together, you're going to get some things that tend to happen. And God said, I don't want you to breed those different together. This, once again, was quality in your genetics. He made everything, remember from the beginning, he said, I made everything after its kind, and it was good. So he didn't say, plus I've mixed a few things together just to see how it worked. Man does that all the time, thinking he can make a better product than God, and it's always inferior. How do I know? You can't make anything better than God. It can't be done. And any time mankind in his own wisdom tries to do that, God shakes his head. He says, they're doing something I've not put together. That's not the way I designed it. So when you do wool and linen mixed together, once again, this is talking about quality. That statute applies for God's people today to do quality because we are a holy people. We are a people of God. And he says, I want you to eat befittingly. I want you to dress befittingly. The same way, that same mindset. So these were physical matters that had to do with purity, but they had spiritual principles having to do with the way God designed his creation. And the last one here, there were also laws that actually governed warfare. Well, why didn't God just say, well, don't fight? Well, he did. He doesn't want you to hate, but he did have Israel go into the land of Canaan and wipe out, frankly, sometimes men, women, and children. And people don't understand that. That was a cruel God back then. No, he was a God that knew that these people were so defiled that there was no turning back from their mentality that they had already set. Not only the laws of purity were done away with, but there was bestiality, there was sodomy taking place, as there is today. God said, you've got to go wipe them all out because that mentality will not change among the mentality of the people. And they will be resurrected to live a way of life that will be taught according to God's laws. That was mercy killing. God's mercy was back then. We can identify with that. But yeah, he said, okay, you're going to go do a war? Here's the rules. Deuteronomy 20, verse 19. Let's actually take a look here. Isn't this interesting? And these actually were intertwined with the laws of the environment. Do you know, when you go to warfare, it's not every person do as he wants. There was law here. Deuteronomy 20, 19. When you besiege a city for a long time, while making war against it to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them. If you can eat of them, do not cut them down to use in the siege, for the tree of the field is man's food. Once again, what's the point here? Did it really, really matter? What was God's point? It came to the mindset. See, man, now it's get everything. I don't care about anybody else. I see it. I want it. I don't care about anybody else in the future. God was saying, this is going to provide for other people coming down into the future. And the mindset is, well, is there anything wrong particularly with cutting a tree down? Is that going to really do anything? Yeah, maybe not if there are a lot of other trees. It all had to do with the mentality of caring for somebody else and for caring about what God said to do. He said, verse 20, but he did allow certain trees to be cut. Only the trees which you know are not trees for food, you make to destroy and cut down to build siege works against that city and to make war with you until it is subdued. He had specific laws, believe it or not, that had to do even with warfare. So we can see once again, when we're looking at the laws, it's almost like five sermons. It's very difficult to cover it all. There are probably more questions. There are more, you would call, anomalies in there. Go, what's the purpose of that? As you look through it, it's sometimes hard to be understood. But once we look at through God's laws, let's examine what is God's intent. God's laws were made to be observed. We see the ones that were changed. We've identified those according to the priesthood, the administration of death. But we're going to see, brethren, the important thing about this is these laws will be a part of God's kingdom. Part of us now, because as Christ came to magnify the law and make it honorable, what's our job as his people? To magnify it and make it honorable. Not to add to it and not to diminish from it. Final verse here, Micah chapter 4, verse 2. We're going to see what's going to happen with the rest of the nations that don't know of God's laws, that will be taught God's laws and the principles. And they'll say, well, what's that? That doesn't make sense. What's the purpose of this one here? Micah chapter 4, verse 2. And many nations will come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord and to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For the law will go forth of Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. That's the way it is now. That's what will be that way in the future. Let us honor God's law, understand its intent, and walk in its ways, and watch the blessings flow.